He never gets involved like this. He knows how, though, from his time as a prosecuting attorney. I think that maybe he's more worried about the town's image than I thought, and not for East Bay, but for his future political career. He launches in.
Oh, the place is clean. No prints, no blood. Luminol test was negative. It could be housekeeping. They were in here the next morning. They told the manager nothing was out of place. Even the bed was made.
But they still changed the sheets?
Yeah, and the towels.
There should be some prints on the doorknobs.
No, they still follow COVID protocol. They wipe down every surface.
But the luminol can't wash away blood proteins. Must not have bled here. So, where did he get that wound on his neck?
Got me. I mean, maybe on the deck?
Let's see what the autopsy says. If he died from that wound, there has to be something left behind in the tissue. Skin, most likely. From the murder weapon. Which could then be in this room. Or maybe he died somewhere else.
Well, that would make this case a lot harder.
Yeah.
Why do you seem relieved?
Rob stares at me, and I know I can't look away. I am relieved, and he's right to wonder why. I can feel the words in my throat. I'm choking on them. Just tell him. Tell him about Brooke. But I can't do it. I've already made the decision, and yet every step I take further down this road of deception will make it harder to walk back. I check myself, make sure I'm not compromising the investigation beyond what I've already done. I can't overlook a shred of evidence that Peter Walsh was killed in this room, from the violent sounds Brooke heard through the wall, even if that means she'll have to be a part of this. She'll have to tell Aiden. I think then about the room next door. Hey, you got the manager's cell?
Yeah, why? He went back to the office. The hotel rents a space downtown.
I want to get into the room next door, the one behind that wall. I point to the wall behind the bed, facing away from the sliding doors that go to the balcony. Rob shrugs, looking at me with a strange expression. Maybe he knows I'm about to lie right to his face.
What for?
To see what the other guests might have heard that night. I got a name. Jamie's tracking them down.
Okay, well, the owner is a little maniacal about privacy. There's no staff on the premises, unless they're requested. He has no cameras. There's different paths to each room from the parking lot. And he said the walls are soundproof.
Well, I would like to see for myself. Last time I checked, I'm still the one with the badge.
I'm not trying to step on your toes, Care. I'm just conveying information. I asked if we could get in there, and he said tomorrow morning, after the guests who are staying there now leave. The wall's not going anywhere.
Yeah, I think a murder investigation takes priority here.
It's not a murder investigation yet, remember? And until it is, you know you can't get a warrant. You got lucky getting into this room.
Just give me the cell number. Rob finally agrees and hands me the manager's business card. Then he says he's going to walk the grounds, see what he can find. I tell him I'll stay here, see if they've missed anything. When he's gone, I slip booties on my feet and walk to the wall behind the bed. I picture Brooke sitting on the other side of it while David Paul pours a drink. I picture Peter Walsh here, maybe in this bed, with a woman who wasn't his wife. And then a fight. The thud against the wall that's left no mark, and if it did, someone's cleaned it up. I press my ear to it and hear nothing but the sound of my own heart beating. I knock against the drywall. I can feel the vibration. I can hear the sound, though it is muted. Then again, I'm on the same side of whatever materials have been used to afford privacy. I think about how voices carry, even through thick walls. And when I step away, a memory rushes in, so suddenly it takes my breath away. I see all of the pieces of it right there, static, like the furniture in this room. Brooke on my bed, Tyler standing in the corner. It's my room, not Eve's. They're soaking wet, Brooke and Tyler. They've run here from the inn on a Saturday afternoon. I get them clothes from my closet, sweatpants and t-shirts. I grab towels from the bathroom in the hallway. Brooke begins, speaking in fragments. They've overheard another fight between their parents through the door to their bedroom. This wasn't the first time, and it never caused Brooke to run out into the rain. She usually saved it for Eve's house when we were getting ready to go somewhere. She'd drop it in casually as if it meant nothing to her. She was so used to it by then. Her mother screaming things, her father shushing her. "The kids can hear us," he would say. And Tyler would look at his sister like, "Make it stop." And she would look back like, "That's not how this goes, Ty. Just gotta ride it out." Mrs. Lowry complained about everything and nothing. How Mr. Lowry was running the inn into the ground. How the guests walked all over him. He was a pathetic, weak man. He might as well be dead for all the good he did. The rain was pouring down, pounding the asphalt street outside my window. I remember all of it, each piece, as I walk outside the room now and look out at the river below, where Peter Walsh's body was likely dumped, or where he may have fallen. That day, years ago, I held Brooke in my arms as she fought to catch her breath. I turned to Tyler and asked what happened this time.
Did they hurt each other?
No.
Then what? Tyler, tell me. Hey, what did they say?
Tyler shook his head and looked at his bare feet. He wiped tears from his eyes, but I couldn't stop asking. Brooke was hysterical.
Ty, just say it.
He paced then, back and forth, his arms crossed, his long hair wet and clinging to the sides of his face. I asked again and again, until I was almost yelling at him to just say the words. I couldn't imagine what could be this bad. And then, finally, he stopped, his face bright red, and he screamed.
I know you're fucking her!
And then Brooke pulled away from me, grabbing both of my arms to steady herself.
Brooke, just tell me, what did your mother say to him?
Her entire body was shaking as she finished the story about this fight between her parents, the accusation her mother had made against her father, the one that had sent them both running from the house in the rain.
She said, why don't you go tell your daughter that you're fucking Eve Shay?
Chapter 16. Brooke. July 1st, 2025. The house where I grew up is hidden in the woods next to the inn. My father had it built when he bought the place. I was 8, Tyler was 5, just starting kindergarten. I remember feeling like we were royalty in East Bay, that my father was the king. But my mother put an end to that over the years with her incessant complaints about money and my father's ineptitude. How was it possible we didn't have more when he owned the largest piece of real estate in the county? What I remember now, as I pass the inn and turn down the narrow driveway, is the yelling behind the closed door of their bedroom and Tyler coming to my room. Like I could do anything about it. I was in no position to save him. Not then, and not years later after Eve died. The scar on his neck is proof of that. I grab my purse and my phone and see the thumbs up emoji next to my message to Aiden. Then I swallow the recoil at my own behavior as I walk to the front door and step inside.
Hello? Anyone home?
It smells of air conditioning and garlic. Musty wood floors beneath old wall-to-wall carpet. The draperies are closed and the lights are off. My mother thinks this saves money on the electric bill. I hear her voice from the kitchen and remember why I never want to come back here.
Who's there?
I walk through the family room, where a news channel blares on the TV, passing the worn sectional that consumes the small space, and the recliner. Brown leather, with an adjustable tray table sitting beside it. A coffee mug and half-eaten sandwich have been left behind for my father to pick up when he returns from the inn. I imagine he'll be there for a while after a dead body was hauled onto his dock. I pause before passing the framed entry to the kitchen. Stealing myself for the woman who raised me. I step inside and find her sitting at the kitchen table, another coffee mug cradled between her palms. She's wearing a tank top and slacks, and a look on her face that strikes a nerve inside me.
What are you doing here in this heat?
I just stopped by to check on everyone.
What for?
Because of the body? The one in the fishing net?
Ugh, such a nuisance. And in this heat.
I know, Mom. It is hot.
Hotter than hell is what it is. Did you close the door behind you? You kids are always leaving it open.
Yes, Mom, I closed the door. Is Ty home?
You think he tells me? Comes and goes as he pleases, working at that diner? after everything we gave him.
Mom.
And you. All that money on college, and you don't even have a job. After everything we gave you.
She gets up and walks to the sink with her mug. She sets it inside and runs the water as she draws a long breath and exhales with a sigh, gazing out the window at the small bit of the ocean that peeks through the trees. And while she takes another breath, I hold mine deep inside my lungs, frozen as I anticipate what she might say next. Maybe about me not having children, or my book not being on the New York Times list. Sometimes she tells me about novels she's read from there, and how good they are, and that I should read them, making her point that my book wasn't a bestseller. And still, I feel the child inside me expecting her to turn around and be a mother. It's the lesson I never remember, no matter how many times I learn it. So now I remind myself why I'm here, and break the silence that sits between us.
Okay, well, I'm just gonna go see if Ty is home. Say hello.
I take a step toward the doorway, but she stops me, turning from the sink. Her eyes are suddenly clear and sharp as knives.
Just like that friend of yours.
What?
When her body was spit out by the ocean.
Jesus, Mom.
What? You weren't thinking the same thing?
No, I wasn't. It was 15 years ago.
Almost to the day. Eve. Was that her name? Lovely Eve Shay.
I have to go.
I'm almost through the doorway when I hear her call after me.
Close the door when you leave.
I walk as fast as I can, away from her voice that bounces off the walls and echoes in my head, to the side door that leads to the garage and the small apartment above it where my brother lives. I wasn't here when he overdosed in the game room at the inn. I was at college, and I had no idea what kind of shit he'd been using. He seemed okay when I left for school that fall, and for the next 2 years when I came home for holidays. Would I have noticed if he wasn't? Should I have? I climb the stairs and knock on the door. I can hear the video game blaring from the speakers, the hobby that started years ago. Pops of explosions as he clears a path to some virtual room where he'll face more obstacles he needs to blow up. The sound cuts, replaced by shuffling. Then the turn of the lock and the door opens, revealing my brother. In spite of everything, he looks better than he has in a long time. Cleanly shaved, combed hair. He smells of musk and sage from some soap or shampoo. Even the apartment is clean. Still, I don't like being here, where my mother is off her leash and I'm reminded of how close we came to losing Tyler. My father talks about it like he was a victim of a scourge, caught up in something out of his control, out of anyone's control. It's everywhere, all the time, but more insidious in small towns like ours where you can't see beyond the life that exists here. And when that life becomes intolerable, people look for an escape within the borderlines, never thinking to cross them. My mother has a far less complicated explanation. Some kids turn out wrong, she says, like a cake that doesn't rise after you've followed the recipe and set the oven to the right temperature. She doesn't blame it on a higher power. God or the universe. Just bad luck. As if it had nothing to do with the things she did and said inside this house. Nothing to do with the things we both had to do to shut her out. And nothing to do with Eve. To be fair, none of us knew how much Tyler loved Eve. It was a schoolboy crush. He was only 13 when his heart was broken. I could have been nicer to him back then, I suppose. But he was my little brother, and it was annoying the way he wanted to go with me whenever I left the house. I knew he just wanted to see Eve. I told him it was pointless. She was practically a grown woman, and he was in the dark abyss of male puberty. As I look at him now, I can still see the scrawny teenager cowering in the corner of my room as we listened to our parents down the hall. It was familiar at first, like a storm that blows in and blows out. We'd take cover, knowing its arc. He would stare at the floor, listening intently, trying to understand. And I would stare at him, frozen on my bed or at my desk, my mind telling me to do something, pound on the walls, scream at them to stop, take Tyler in my arms. But instinct always held me in place, frozen. Until that one day when the storm turned into something else.
Will you stop it? You're out of your mind!
I know exactly what's going on. I've never been more sane than right now. Why don't you go tell your daughter?
Stop it!
Go! Go on, right now! Tell her!
You're crazy.
Go! Tell her that you're sleeping with her friend. Tell everyone how you're fucking Eve Shay!
That day, I grabbed Tyler by the hand and led him out the front door into the rain. We ran all the way to Carrie's house, the one person we could tell. I knew she would take it to her grave, that she would keep it from everyone, always, even from our best friend. I'll always wonder what might have been if I'd gone to Eve's house instead. She had a right to know if it was a lie, and I had a right to know if it was true. Tyler was more devastated than I was. He was in love with Eve. I know it's a different feeling at 13 when you've never even been kissed, but it still fills your heart, then breaks it into pieces. Tyler takes a step back, surprise spreading over his face. He lets me in, then closes the door behind us. He asks me why I'm here, in his apartment. I walk to his desk, where he has his console, 3 screens and 2 keyboards. And I tell him, finally, I need you to look for someone who doesn't want to be found.
Chapter 17. Eve, July 4th, 2010. Just as Luke pushed my hand away and continued to block the door, a group of college kids walked up to the entrance of the Cosmos Arcade from the pier. They wanted to get inside. One of the guys, the big one, tapped Luke's shoulder and told him to get out of the way. He stepped to the side, but his eyes stayed on me. I could see the hurt in them and smell the alcohol seeping from his skin. He'd been drinking all night. The boardwalk ended at the pier, and the beach was dark. I thought about going farther south into Crichton, but then what? What if Luke followed me? Or Connor? What did I think they would actually do? Part of me wanted to just find out, call their bluff. They were being bullies. Maybe I needed to stand up to them. And then I heard my mother's words again, how they'll always be stronger. And I knew whatever was going to happen if I drew them into a confrontation would be their decision and not mine. So fuck that, I thought. I didn't try to leave. Instead, I folded in with the college kids, getting past Connor and making my way to the bathrooms in the back corner. One thing I knew for sure was that Connor would never follow me into the ladies' room. It was small. Only 3 stalls, and 1 old porcelain sink with a broken soap dispenser and watermarks around the drain. The room smelled of pee that had sprayed on the seats. Girls liked to squat so they didn't touch anything. Paper towels were matted on the floor beneath my feet, overflowing from the garbage bin. Standing over the sink, I ran the water as I looked in the mirror. My hair was wild from the wind and the salty air. The mascara I had put on was smeared. I pooled water between my hands and splashed it on my face. I grabbed a paper towel and rubbed beneath my eyes, removing the black streaks. What was I doing? What had I done? I was tired in my body, but also in my mind. So tired of thinking about what to do. And my heart. My heart was filled with guilt about my father wondering where I was, and about Carrie, who I knew was at home, feeling lonely and left out. Feeling rejected by me and Brooke, betrayed even. And Brooke, so much had happened in the past hour I had forgotten about our fight on the beach before she left. I was worried about her going to meet Jeremy Ashbourne. As I played it back in my mind, I knew we could never unsay the words that were said.
Maybe you shouldn't go tonight.
Are you kidding right now? I've been waiting all year for this.
I know, but maybe just pick another night when you haven't had so much to drink. He's not...
What?
There are going to be so many guys at Brown. Tell Jeremy you have to go home. Tell him your father found out.
Are you really bringing my father into this?
What?
I know what you did.
What are you talking about?
Just admit it already.
Admit what? What did I do?
You know what, Eve? I kind of hate you anyway.
She walked away then, just like Carrie had. But I didn't call after her. I let her go. I didn't know what she thought I did. Maybe she thought I'd told Carrie about her plans with Jeremy. But I did know why she said she hated me. I'd felt it simmering all year. It was about her father, Mr. Lowry, who'd given me jobs for 4 years when he didn't always need the help. We'd grown close because of it, and I know it bothered Brooke. I spent more time with him than she could, and he had become a confidant. He told me things about his wife, Brooke's mother, that I didn't share with anyone, about how she wasn't always like this, how they used to have great adventures together.
She was always looking for them. Maybe to escape what was going on in her mind. Well, whatever the reason, it was different then.
He said he wondered if settling down and having a family had killed that part of her, and if it had caused her to become a different person. He asked me what I dreamed about and told me I should never settle for anything less. That was the lesson he had learned from Mrs. Lowry. I never told him how I felt about it, that I thought he should do more to stop her from saying the things she did to Brooke and Tyler. It felt pointless and cruel. I knew he didn't have it in him to stand up to her, and he would ask me about my father, how we were getting on, what my life was like in my house, if my father was taking care of me. He told me I could tell him anything, so I did. Sometimes we just talked about the guests at the inn. We had our jokes about them and could make each other laugh with just a look. But I would be lying if I said that's all our relationship was, friendship. Sometimes when he looked at me, I could see that boy inside of him, wanting to go back in time to when life was easier. Maybe when Mrs. Lowry was still full of adventure, or maybe even before he met her. In those awkward moments, I would look away until he changed back to the grown man, my boss, my friend's father. Maybe I'd done more harm than good being this close to a man like that, but he made me feel safe and protected, the things I didn't feel at home. My father was the one who needed protecting, from his grief and his fear of what might become of me without my mother. So I let Brooke leave without saying a word, believing whatever it was she believed. She walked past the bonfire and up to the dunes. I assumed she made it to her car at the end of Connor's driveway, drove across town to Jeremy Ashbourne's house, and was probably with him right then, while I stood here, trapped inside the arcade bathroom by two boys who had once held me in their arms. I checked my phone, feeling the urge to call Brooke or Carrie and ask for help, but I couldn't do it, not after the fights I'd had with both of them. And what would I tell them anyway? I stepped away from the sink, and suddenly I felt a gust of hot air. When I turned to see where it was coming from, I noticed that there was a small window inside the bathroom. It was up high, but it was the kind that slides, and it was open. An open window. A way out. And then came a knock on the door.
Knock, knock! We know you're in there!
Just go in, man.
Come out and play!
I grabbed the metal trash can and dragged it to the wall beneath the window. I stood on it, bracing my hand against the bathroom stall, and when I was hoisted up, I looked outside. The window faced a small alley in the back between the beach and a metal fence separating it from the dunes. From there, I could walk to the access road. I grabbed hold of the rim with both hands, felt the metal casing dig into them, and then my waist as I began to lean over, head first. I was able to pull one knee up and through, so I was straddling the wall. I pulled the other leg out, scraping against the metal, my shorts catching on something sharp, tearing a hole. But I didn't stop. Once I had both feet on the other side, I hung from the window by my hands and looked down. I didn't know how far it was, but I didn't care. I let go and dropped to the gravel and the weeds, letting myself collapse and roll. When I realized I wasn't hurt, I stood up and shook myself off. And I was free. I knew then that I was going to make it. Before I took another step, I leaned against the wall and bent over at the waist. I felt sick. A wave of nausea came and went, and I let it pass, choking it back. And then I felt the tears come. A different kind of release caused by the bodies of those two boys. Not pleasure, but the fear they had created inside me. The fear and the rage.
Chapter 18. Carrie, July 2nd, 2025. I sleep hour by hour, waking to images of Peter Walsh dead in that fishing net, and then back to the day they found Eve. My mother heard about her body from the East Bay PD hours before they made a formal announcement. She thought I would stay here and wait for news of what they'd found, that I would let her comfort me. Instead, I ran from our house to the beach, so fast she couldn't keep up. I stopped when I got over the dunes and saw the police tape, the white tent, the swarm of officials from all over the state. Eve had been missing for 6 weeks. The investigation had stalled. No one thought she had run away or been abducted. Her clothes were on the beach. It had already been ruled an accidental drowning. I was standing there with a handful of others who had come for an early morning walk, or who lived on the water and saw the commotion from their porches and decks. No one knew what had been found, who had been found, except for me and Brooke Lowry. I heard Brooke calling my name from down the beach. She had seen the swarm of police cars and vans, seen the white tent all the way from the inn. I left the crowd to meet her, and we stood, alone, on the same beach we'd been on that horrible night. We'd been talking every day since, trying to make sense of things. Why Eve would have gone into the water when she couldn't swim, and where might she have gone? Did we miss a clue? She'd worn her red and white striped shirt, and what did that mean, if anything? She never wore that shirt. She said it was too low cut, too tight, and it was, but then I remember how pretty she looked. What secret was she keeping from us? Brooke grabbed hold of my arms and squeezed them like she might never let them go, and I started to cry so hard I could barely get out the words.
Brooke, no! No, Carrie! No, it's not her, right? No, it's not! Tell me, it's not Eve!
I couldn't answer, but I didn't need to, because right then, we both heard a cry coming over the dunes, a man struggling to run in the soft sand which swallowed each step, deeper and deeper, as he called out his daughter's name.
Eve! Eve!
That day will never leave me. I reach for my phone on the table and read the message from Jamie. I play the anonymous tip again. Then I give in to the thought that's kept me awake, and type out a text. Can you run the DNA on the Shea baby again? I stop before hitting send. Seriously, what am I doing? When Eve's body was found and they discovered she was pregnant, they ran the DNA against CODIS, but that was just as unlikely to find a match then as it was when I got the file. And as it is now, the chances that someone arrested after her death for something unrelated to it had also gotten Eve pregnant that summer, and then maybe killed her. Sometimes I fantasized about a summer kid Eve never told about, someone she met for one night, like Brooke had done. And then, when she told him she was pregnant, he killed her by dragging her out to the water where she couldn't swim. And since then, maybe he'd been arrested for something requiring DNA, rape, home invasion. I could see that, especially if killing Eve had messed up his brain. Ugh. Just listening to these thoughts. I need to stop. I hit send, but then quickly try to redeem myself. Hey, first, can you double down on that search for David Paul? That has to be the priority. I have to focus on Peter Walsh and what might have happened to him in the room next door to Brooke and her lover. I listen now for the sounds of my mother and daughter in the kitchen, but then I remember that Sylvie is with her dad for 3 nights, and that my marriage is in trouble. And not just because of Eve anymore. Brooke spoke of desire when she told me about her lover. She spoke about it when we were teenagers, about Jeremy Ashbourne. Eve did too, telling us about her afternoons with Connor in his house, how his parents were on different floors and knew what they were doing in his room. I never told her how strange I thought that was. I didn't want to take away from her joy. She seemed to have that with Connor, until Luke ruined it. I didn't know desire then. I tried to imagine it when I listened to Brooke and Eve, when they looked at me incredulously because I swore that I had never felt that for anyone, the things they were describing. And that was true, until I met Rob. I don't know what it was about him, what it still is about him, that lights me up. He came to town 8 years ago canvassing for a local congressman. He had plans to run for office himself one day. And this was the first step in that journey. From there, he said he'd look for work as a prosecuting attorney. They always made good politicians. There were no limits to his ambition, no doubts in his mind about what he could accomplish. Is that what it was? The hold he had over me? We got married because of Sylvie, but I would have married him after our first night together. Everything Brooke said about how David Paul made her feel, I had felt with Rob, how he could set me on fire with one touch. My mother told me last night when I got home that it was a good sign we were working together on this new case. Rob didn't have to involve himself in police business, even though he had the right to. She said maybe this was his way of finding his way back to me. After all, she said, it won't look good for him to be divorced. She tried to take it back the second the words left her mouth, but I could see the wheels spinning in her head, how Rob's ambitions might force him to reconcile. And from there, what? An unhappy marriage for the sake of his political career? The truth is, the separation was his idea, which means he's willing to take the risk. That's how unhappy he is with me. And nothing about the Peter Walsh investigation has anything to do with him wanting to reconcile. Maybe it's over already. Okay, so maybe that means I can do what I want now with Eve's case, following that tip and protecting Brooke Lowry. Did I just think that? That my marriage is over? Ugh, stop, Carrie. Get out of bed. An hour later, I'm on the road to meet with Rob at the morgue. The medical examiner has come down from Hartford to perform the autopsy. We weren't expecting any results for hours, but she has something to show us, something she needs us to see and then report to the wife, Renee Walsh. On the drive, I pull my thoughts away from Eve and my marriage and get my head back into the case. I think about the rooms at the Four Points, the balcony and the river and the wall between them. I need to get back there, but the manager wants us gone. It's already the slow season for them, and we're not helping. I need that warrant. The morgue is at the office of the chief medical examiner, half an hour northwest of East Bay. It's a rectangular beige building with no windows, and looks like a place you could enter and never find your way out. Sterile. Bleak. I can't imagine having to identify a loved one inside it. I pull into the lot and park next to Rob's SUV. He's already out, leaning against the side, waiting for me.
Morning, Chief.
You're here early? Been inside yet?
Nope. Waiting for the boss.
That's a first.
Come on.
I ignore my husband's strange behavior. We walk in together, side by side. He tells me about his night with Sylvie, how they ate tacos and watched a show on Netflix. Like none of this is getting to him. And why should it? I'm the one with the secrets. Inside, there's a counter where a young man sits with a laptop and stack of papers, typing and turning pages. He looks up when he feels the blast of hot air sweep across the room. I flash my badge and tell him we're working the Peter Walsh investigation. We want to speak with his wife and the medical examiner. He finishes his task, then looks at the badge briefly, before hitting a buzzer which releases a door next to the counter. He tells us it's through there and down the hall. Rob turns to me and asks if I'm okay, like I might not be prepared for this. I haven't handled many homicides, and he knows it. He worked dozens of them when he was a prosecuting attorney. Still, I find it patronizing, even as it settles into the place I still have for him as my husband, my person. I smile and tell him a second time in 5 minutes that I'm fine, and I walk in front as we head down the hall. I can already see Renee Walsh. She gets up at the sound of our footsteps. Peter's wife looks just like the photos I found on the internet. Dirty blonde hair, blue eyes, petite frame. She's dressed neatly in a summer dress and sandals, her makeup fresh, even lipstick, which makes me wonder things about her. What thoughts went through her head when she was told about her husband and asked to come here, to this beige box, and look at his dead body that's been pulled from the ocean? I need to freshen my face? But who am I to judge? Maybe the lipstick makes her feel stronger, strong enough to sit here and wait for us in a metal chair on a cheap linoleum floor, concrete walls that sweat from the blasting air conditioning. We introduce ourselves with straight faces and somber tones, as we tell her we're so sorry for her loss. She thanks us, then fixes her gaze on Rob.
I've already identified my husband's body. I want to go home to my kids.
I understand, but can you give us a minute to speak with the ME? We have some questions for you while you're here.
I gave a statement to the police in Newport. Can't you get it from them? I can't deal with this today. Not today.
Renee's eyes find mine, and I don't know what it is I see there. Some kind of pleading. Like she wants there to be an acknowledgement of what's happening here. That it won't be okay. That we can't solve the problem of her husband being dead. The father of her two children. I reach out for her arm, giving it a squeeze the way Brooke did on the beach the morning they found Eve's body. Let's talk about it after we know more, okay? Just give us a few minutes. Renee backs away from me, looking at Rob again, studying his face as we turn to leave. But then she sits down, and we continue through the hall to another set of doors, then down a new corridor, following the signs to the forensic pathology lab where the medical examiner is performing the autopsy. When we get there, Dr. Mary Keith buzzes us into the room.
Yeah, sorry to pull you away from the investigation. Did you find anything in the room?
No, not yet.
Okay, well, take a look at this.
Dr. Keith directs us to the body of Peter Walsh that lies beneath a plastic sheet. She pulls it back to his chest, exposing his neck and the wound we saw at the dock when it was still entangled in the trawling net.
This wasn't made by anything in the water. No, it's too deep and too smooth. Something long and round, like the handle of a broom or a pipe, it struck him hard against the left carotid artery. It didn't break the skin, the bleeding was internal, and it crushed his windpipe. The guy drowned in his own blood before he hit the water.
God damn.
Could it be the railing of a fence? There's one at the hotel on the porch that overlooks the river.
No, except there's no evidence of wood, no splinters, which I would expect to see with an impact of this degree. I'm thinking metal, hard plastic, or glass that didn't shatter on impact.
So, a weapon? Or something improvised?
Yeah, that's why I called you down here. Now, I still have some work to do, but I think I'm going to be ruling this a homicide.
Dr. Keith continues talking about the possible objects that might have been used to kill Peter Walsh, and the amount of force it required, and the angle of the strike. Someone right-handed, possibly a woman, but she would have to be at least 5'6", or standing on something. The wound is dead on. And while she talks, I think about the box of evidence that used to be under my desk, and then the storage room, and now in the trunk of my car because of that anonymous tip. I think about the wood splinters on Eve's back, and the paint scrapings under her nails, and the rope burns around her waist. And how the medical examiner who performed her autopsy explained all of these things as objects she encountered in the water, probably a mooring post off someone's dock, when she went for a swim, leaving her clothes on the beach in a neat pile. Going into the water when she couldn't swim? And when she'd never done that before? Not drunk or on drugs, she didn't even have a sip at the beach party, the bonfire. She said she was pacing herself, that she would drink later. I wonder now if she knew she was pregnant, and if maybe she wanted to keep it. When we're done with the ME, we leave to find Renee Walsh and give her the news. Her husband's been murdered. I won't be looking to comfort her, not quite yet, but to gauge her reaction. Everyone's a suspect until they're not. Brooke said she heard a woman in the room next door, and the words they spoke sounded intimate. A lover, or a wife. I turn to Rob as we walk.
I want that warrant now,
for the room next door. I'm calling the prosecutor myself.
Hey, do what you gotta do, Chief.
We head back out to find Renee Walsh, down the hallway to the second set of doors. But when we get to the metal chairs where Renee Walsh was waiting, it's empty. She's gone.
Chapter 19. Brooke. July 2nd, 2025. Earlier, I left Tyler's apartment at my parents' house and went home to Aiden. The night wasn't easy. I was agitated, worried, terrified, if I'm being honest. Tyler was helpful, but I wasn't sure if it would be enough. Carrie wanted David Paul in person for an interview. All I had were unanswered messages and calls on Signal, and now some technical stuff Tyler had printed out for me. The best lies stay close to the truth. That had been my strategy from the moment the affair started, telling Aiden I was at the writers' group held by the library in New Haven. It's a large branch, and the group is more of a lecture series held every Tuesday night. People come when they want, depending on the work being discussed. Sometimes they have the author there to give us tips, hoping we'll buy their books after. Mine wasn't big enough to be one of them, the novel being with an independent hybrid press, one step up from self-published, my mother likes to remind me. I don't care about any of that. I wrote a novel about a girl who goes missing in a small town. And hidden between each line, I was able to say everything I needed to about Eve Shay. Aiden was in the kitchen making dinner, grilled swordfish and some little potatoes. He was drinking a glass of wine and listening to music from his generation. A Springsteen song was playing. Brilliant disguise of all the things. I told Siri to turn it off when I walked in from the foyer.
So, they found a body in the water. Did you hear about that?
Yeah, that's crazy, right? I heard they brought it to the inn. Your father called to see if you were all right. I told him you went to the house to see him. Didn't you say he'd asked you to come?
Oh, stupid. I should have known my father would call Aiden, my older, protective husband. I stumbled for a reply.
I did, and I got it wrong. Tyler was the one who told me Daddy needed something, but it was all fine. A misunderstanding. So I just spent some time with my mother and Tyler.
Your mother?
Yeah. She kind of cornered me.
Ah, yes. I'm sorry, sweetheart. It must have been difficult. On top of that body being dragged out of the water.
I walked right to him then, and wrapped my arms around his waist. I buried my face in his chest so he couldn't see it as I recalibrated. Then I spoke to him softly.
I brought up some memories.
Oh, I didn't even think of that. Your friend, right? Eve?
Yeah. Her body washed up on the beach. It'll be 15 years on the 4th. They're already setting up the fireworks.
I broke away from him, and we both looked out the window at the barge anchored just offshore.
Is that why you've been so anxious these past few days? I didn't want to say anything.
Why? You can always say things to me. You know that.
I do. Here, let me get you a glass of wine, pull the shade so we don't even see the water, and disappear in front of the TV. Sound good?
I didn't deserve this man. Truly. He'd read my novel. He said he could see the pain Eve's death had caused me. He said it was beautiful, the way I'd captured her. Of course, I didn't write anything about her relationships with older men, how she sought their attention to fill the void left by her mother's death and her absent father, or how she broke a boy's heart in two and loved another one who was a complete asshole. Eve lives in our memories the way I wrote her in the novel. But that wasn't the whole story. Just the good parts. Aiden and I drank an entire bottle of wine with dinner. We watched a movie with the shades drawn and the windows closed, blocking the sights and sounds of the water that took her life. And then we went to bed, where I initiated sex the way I knew would be quick for him, taking me from behind with the lights on. Sometimes I let him grab my hair. He'd probably seen that move when he used to watch porn. They all do. Women complain about it, but on nights like this, when I needed him to feel close to me, quickly and without much effort, it comes in very handy. I slept on and off, dreaming about fishing boats and nets, the room at the Four Points, the sound of jeans dropped to the floor, the buckle of the belt that he wrapped around my wrists, and then Eve at the bonfire, kissing her lips, which were soft and wet, so different from a man's mouth. Then the fight we had, and the last words I said to her.
You know what, Eve? I kind of hate you anyway.
That wasn't true. I loved Eve even more because of the things about her that weren't perfect, or good even. It made her real to me. It made her capable of understanding the things I did that weren't good, that were sometimes bad. Carrie was different. We loved her, but not the same way. She was forgiving, but that was the thing. The fact that she felt we needed forgiveness in the first place. Earlier that morning, I begged her to meet me. She came right after seeing Peter Walsh's body at the morgue. Now, here we are, parked side by side on Leroy Street, just like the day before. I get out of my car and into hers. Then I hand her the papers Tyler had given me.
What is all this?
It's the search my brother did on David Paul. He used the information I had about him, his age, town, kids, job, and then he used three different AI programs and it spit out three people, none of them matching exactly. And then their photos, they're not my David.
So you're showing me search results that failed?
I thought it would help. So your team doesn't have to duplicate the effort.
Brooke, my team is doing things by their own protocol. They're not going to rely on anything Tyler does.
I was just trying to help.
I lose it then, sobbing into my hands while Carrie makes the sigh she used to make when we were kids. The sigh of forgiveness. And it makes me so mad, I start to cry harder.
God, I know what you think of me, Kerr. You don't understand how betrayed I feel by this man. But then I know I have no right to feel that way because I'm the one who betrayed my husband. And with a man who has disappeared, leaving me with this, connection to the Four Points and a dead man.
And then a breath rushes in. Carrie said she was coming from the morgue. She must know something now about the way Peter Walsh died.
Did you find out if he was, you know...
murdered?
Yeah. Could they tell? And was it at the hotel?
I can't share that with you. You know that. Brooke, I want to help you. I really do.
Okay, then help me. Tell me if what we heard was a murder.
Carrie turns her gaze from the breaking waves we can see over the dunes. I can tell she's deeply troubled by keeping my secret and conflicted over whether she should do more or just hit the brakes and drag me down to the station to give a statement. Me and Aiden, who will have to verify that I wasn't home, that I was gone every Tuesday night for months, and that I came home late while he was asleep on the sofa, and that will be the end of my marriage, my life that I've worked so hard to build. Then suddenly, she pulls out her phone.
Peter Walsh's wife, Renee, she left the morgue before we could question her. She left before we could tell her what the ME found on her husband's body.
What? Okay, wait, so do you think she... Oh my God.
Slow down. Okay. I'll tell you this much. We haven't spoken to her yet, but Newport PD says she has an alibi. They're gonna bend over backwards to protect her. Her family's connected.
Okay, but what do you think?
I want to play something for you. It's a video my team pulled from Renee Walsh's Facebook page. Her voice is on it, and Peter's.
And you want to know if I recognize them? From the room next door?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Here, listen.
Carrie plays a video, and I listen intently. It's a video Renee made from some trip she took with her family to Florida. She and Peter are both on it, talking about the magnificent weather.
What do you think?
I stare at the phone, then ask her to play it again.
I'm not sure. I mean, it could be. I think it could be.
Carrie puts down her phone and looks at me with that face I know so well. The one she always gets before she tells me something I don't want to hear.
Okay, we have to find David Paul. If he can identify the voice he heard belonging to Renee Walsh, we'll have a suspect. But that also means...
we are witnesses to a crime. Okay, I know that's what happened, Carrie. You wouldn't be here if they'd found no evidence of a murder.
Look, one thing at a time. Okay, let's find this guy.
Carrie pulls me into her arms the way she did the morning Eve's body was found. And I fall into them and pray that they might save me.
Chapter 20. Eve. July 4th. 2010. Tears streamed down my face as I ran from the pier, over the dunes to the beach, and then the access road. My eyes were fixed on the moonlit asphalt, feet pounding beneath me, chest heaving, sucking in air. I started to run so fast, the tears were landing on the back of my neck. The moon was so high and bright. I could see the white tips on the waves as the tide came in and the wind picked up. I reached the border of East Bay, where the boardwalk ends and the shore is hidden behind the houses owned by the summer people and families like the Rosarios who could afford to retire here. I steadied my pace
and let my heart settle down. With it came a reprieve from the thoughts and the regrets, and the anger at Luke and Connor. I've gone over things in my head a million times. How I was drawn to Luke with his persistence, his heart on his sleeve, his kindness to the workers at the inn. And I fell for him that night. The vulnerable kid with the father who didn't understand him, or maybe didn't care. The way he described being out on the field, the physicality of it, the constant fear of dropping the ball, but also of catching it and getting tackled to the ground, his body aching every day, and all he wanted to do was study history. Where had he gone? That boy I thought I loved. Even at prom, he lured me back in. But then, when Connor was screaming at me, calling me names, Luke didn't come to my defense. No, he used me to take a victory lap. And tonight, the way he taunted me at the exit to the arcade and then stood outside the bathroom door, what did he think he was going to do? He and his stupid friends. I got to Connor's house in the driveway where Brooke had parked earlier. The lights were all out. His parents must have gone to bed. And my eyes lingered on the second floor where Connor's room looked out toward the street. I spent hours in that room, behind the closed door. The Rosarios were lenient parents. Mrs. Rosario said that kids were going to do what they needed to do. Drink, smoke weed, have sex. She'd prefer to know that they were safe, rather than doing those things in a place where they might get in trouble. I went to that house almost every afternoon. The tension building between me and Connor all day. Holding hands in the hallway, making out in the back of the building that faced the woods. We couldn't wait to get to his room, take off our clothes as fast as we could. I couldn't wait for him to be inside me. And where did he go? Connor Rosario, the boy I'd spent most of the year with, who said he loved me. As I passed the driveway, I felt a sudden twinge in my gut as these thoughts mingled with the night that was nearly gone. Back in my room with Brooke and Carrie, talking about the beach party and Brooke's hair, how it had to have flowing waves and Carrie's pulled up in a tight ponytail. Then the parking situation and Mr. Rosario's offer to use the driveway, and Carrie thinking this was strange. She'd said it before when I told her he'd helped me with my college scholarships, even after prom, after I broke Connor's heart by lying to him about Luke and being with Luke again, alone in that classroom. I wondered how much he had told his father, and his mother for that matter. Was this something bigger than just high school dating drama? I'd written him letters, sent text messages. I tried to explain how I'd decided that fall, after the summer ended and Luke and I broke up, that I would take it back. My first time. My virginity. That I would have another chance with someone who wasn't total bullshit. And that was all true. When I sat next to Connor in physics class first semester, and when he asked me out so politely, I told myself I would start over with him. This road to discovery. No one would ever have to know. I could even lie to myself. Yeah, like that's ever possible. I knew better. But once it was done, there was no turning back. I told him all of this, but he never responded. Now I stared at his house. I could see the ocean on both sides, the waves spraying the sand. I could hear the soft roar that was growing as the weather changed. I stared and let the thoughts come. The memories of being in Connor's room after we started dating. Then coming downstairs, our faces glowing, my hair unruly. His mother would be on the third floor, in her office, investing the money she'd made to make more of it. Money that had allowed them to retire. Mr. Rosario would be in the kitchen, acting like he didn't know what we'd been doing. He would ask about school and my father, tell me I was welcome to stay for dinner. I can picture him there, in his golf shirt and khakis, his laptop open on the counter, papers sprawled out for his college counseling work. It was all done over video call from the kitchen in his study next door. Was it strange that Mr. Rosario wanted to help me with a few scholarships that were still available for the fall, even after what happened at prom? I'd been going to their house in the afternoons all summer, when I was off from my job at the inn, and Connor was at his job as a golf caddy. We sat at the island I had been at countless times throughout the year, and he showed me the resources he'd found and online applications he'd pulled up on his laptop. I didn't have my own computer, so he offered to do them with me in his kitchen. But then I told him that he could email them to me and I could finish myself. I didn't want to inconvenience him, but mostly I felt uncomfortable being there alone with him, knowing Connor wouldn't like it. I could hear his mother upstairs sometimes. She always left us alone. I assumed she didn't want to see me until a couple of weeks ago when she came down to get an energy drink. I'd been coming to his house, seeing his parents, and Connor never knew. God, maybe Carrie was right. Maybe all of that was strange. And then I saw something else creep from my memories, not in the kitchen, but on the second floor. It was just after winter break last year. Connor had gotten up to use the bathroom, and I'd pulled his comforter over my bare chest, my face pressed into his pillow, savoring the scent of him in the afterglow, the waves of release that were beginning to settle. I'd felt something else, a sense that I wasn't alone. I looked up toward the door that led to the hallway, and I saw it move, closing shut. I heard the soft click of the latch sliding into the strike plate. I thought maybe Connor had left the door open and one of his parents happened to walk past and closed it when they heard us inside. When Connor came out of the bathroom, naked and hard again, I asked him if he remembered closing the door. He said he always made sure it was closed and asked me why. I let it go because he was already back in bed, pulling me beneath him. I remember not even feeling him that time because my heart was racing and my mind was still on what I thought I'd seen and heard and what it meant. That one of his parents had passed by that door when we were together, me and Connor, fucking. And that maybe they had opened it and peeked inside, that they were watching us. These thoughts filled my head as I stared at the house from the road, outside looking in for this first time. I saw a light turn on, coming from the third floor, and then a figure appeared, making a shadow in the window. I saw her there, Mrs. Rosario. And I swear she could see me out on the road, standing in the moonlight. She lifted her hand and waved.
Chapter 21. Carrie, July 2nd, 2025. I leave Brooke a second time. The sound of her pleas for help playing back in my head as I drive. David Paul doesn't want to be found, but that doesn't mean we won't find him. Still, I think about the way she described him, the love they had between them. But he doesn't want this to touch him, and that overrides whatever feelings he may or may not have for her. I try not to draw wider conclusions about their affair, and for that matter, about love, marriage, romantic relationships of any kind. What do I know, having only loved one man? And maybe not enough. I drive home to my mother's house and find her in the kitchen. It's quiet with Sylvie gone, spending the next 3 nights with her father. My mother and I never speak of this, the quiet, or whether it's strange that I now live here with her, that we both enjoy the company, even though she won't let me change a single thing in the house. 3 months have passed, and all I've managed to do is swap out a twin bed for a queen. She greets me with a smile as she chops tomatoes at the sink.
I'm making fish with some veggies from the garden.
Oh, sounds great, Mom. She turns off the sink, shakes the water from her hands, and reaches for a dish towel. She watches me as I open the fridge and pull a bottle of wine from the door, unscrew the top, and pour it into a glass at the table that sits in the center of the room. The same table where I used to get breakfast before school, and where we now both have coffee when we're alone, or cereal when Sylvie's with us. As I take a long sip,